Chapter 9. Vince. Alone in the world, poor Vince flees into the arms of playmates, pets, and primetime actresses and learns that life could not be better.
It was a perfect time for a midlife crisis. I just turned 30, which didn't seem that old, but all these younger rock bands were appearing and I was beginning to feel like a dinosaur. On top of that, I'd just been kicked out of the band I'd spent the last 10 years with, and I had left my wife. Ever since Charisse and I had moved into a huge mansion in Simi Valley to raise our daughter, Skylar, our fighting had escalated. Most memorably on my birthday when she caught Robert Patrick and me talking with a future porn star named Lene at the Roxy and hit me in the nose with a glass, which started a complete ruckus that ended with both of us kicked out of the club. I'd begged Doug a long time for help. I told him that I was having a lot of problems between my wife and my confusion over feeling aged out of rock music at 30. I explained to him that I was badly in need of help. If the band was upset at me for missing rehearsals, I wanted them to understand that it had nothing to do with them. I loved Motley Crue. I would have done anything for them. I don't know if Doug ever told the band about our conversation, because the next thing I knew after our fight at rehearsal during the rainstorm, Doug was calling my house and saying, "The band doesn't want you around anymore. I'm willing to release you from your management contract tonight if you want." I was stunned. I expected that we'd cool off for a week, then I'd get a call from Nikki and we'd start working together again. I just muttered, "Okay," and hung up. I didn't know what else to say. If Doug had been more than a yes man, he could have saved the band. All he had to say was, "Come back and let's talk about it. We will get you a counselor and talk about your problems." Clearly what I was going through wasn't a drinking problem, but a mental problem that was leading to drinking and skipping rehearsal. But instead, he called and fired me and told me not to speak to anyone in the band. That was it. What could I do after that kind of treatment? I had two choices. I could kill myself, or I could go to Hawaii with a stripper and get over it. I chose the latter. I grabbed the first chick I could find, a porn star named Savannah, and took her to Hawaii. She was a gorgeous platinum blonde with soft, perfect curves. Despite the fact that a million guys were jacking off to her movies every day, she was extremely insecure, like a lost little girl. With the band out of my hair, I couldn't see any reason to stay sober, so we brought all the pills and coke we could carry with us. After staying up for 4 days straight at the Maui Hilton, Savannah took one pill too many and dropped to the floor convulsing. I called an ambulance and followed her to the hospital. I'd never seen anyone look so beautiful and innocent while lying overdosed in a stretcher. When she returned to the hotel the next day, we picked up right where we had left off and started partying again. But I was older, and for some reason, not only could I not get as fucked up as I used to, but I couldn't recover as quickly. By the time I returned to LA, I was a mess. I flew to the clinic in Tucson again to dry out. Savannah sent me a different porno picture of herself every day until the sober police found my stash and busted me. By the time I completed treatment, she was dating Pauly Shore. Several years later, she asked me to be her date to the Adult Video News Porno Awards in Las Vegas. I told her I'd go with her, but at the last minute, blew her off for another girl. A few days later, they found her dead in her garage. She had disfigured herself in a car crash that day, then gone home, pulled out a Beretta, and shot herself in the head. She had a lot of other problems in her life then, and I knew the reason wasn't because I had stood her up, but I felt terrible. Where most of the girls in her line of work are just gold diggers, she was never like that. She just wanted somebody to love her. Savannah was the beginning of my descent into Hollywood Babylon. I hadn't really hung out on the scene since we all lived together in the Motley house and ruled the strip. We thought we were on top of the world, and though we were far from it, we were much happier in our ignorance. Hollywood 10 years later was a different place. Leaving Charisse and Skylar in our Simi Valley house, I moved in with Rob Lowe, who had a bachelor pad in the Hollywood Hills. We had become friends because we were both attending Monday night sobriety meetings for celebrities, which was probably the most cliched place a pair like us could meet. We were a tabloid dream team, the bad boy lead singer from Motley Crue and a preppy actor sex symbol who had just been busted in a videotape menage a trois with a 16-year-old girl. Since Rob and his girlfriend had recently broken up for obvious reasons, the two of us went crazy. I'd take him to the Rainbow to have his pick of rock groupies, and he'd take me to decadent film parties at huge mansions in the Hollywood Hills and Bel Air. Our place was always full of chicks, just like the Motley House used to be, except this place was clean. On weekends, I'd get to play with Skylar, which I needed as much as she did because it was my only break from the vortex of abandon that Rob and I were being sucked into. After 6 months, Rob's bachelor life ended when his former girlfriend moved back into the house. By then, I'd found a manager, Bruce Bird, who put me in the studio with Tommy Shaw and Jack Blades to write a song for the soundtrack to a Pauly Shore vehicle called Encino Man. That pretty much blew Nikki and Tommy's theory that I didn't care about music anymore, because they hadn't even released a thing yet. I kept that insult in mind when I sued them for 25% of their future profits and $5 million in damages. It was the gentlemanly thing to do, my lawyer said. My attorney also closed a $4 million deal for me at Warner Brothers, where Mo Austin said, "You know what we should do? We should take Vince and that other rock kid we've got, David Lee Roth, and put them in a band together." "But Dad," his son Michael protested, "they're both singers." I still didn't really know what to do with myself. I had no home and hadn't put together a real band yet. So I moved into the plush Bellage Hotel. They let me park my three Ferraris, Rolls Royce, and motorcycle there. I told you I was going through a midlife crisis. And gave me full run of their restaurant, the Diaghilev, after hours. Since I was hanging out drinking all the time anyway, I decided that I might as well do it in my own club. So me and some buddies bought into a snooty Beverly Hills night spot called Bar One, which was conveniently across the street from the hotel. It had a 5-star restaurant on one side of the room and a bar and dance floor on the other. Paparazzi were always lined up outside trolling for celebrities. Pretty soon, I forgot about Motley Crue. There was too much Bar One to distract me. It was a great place to meet people. I'd have dinner with Sylvester Stallone or make out with Tori Spelling and Shannon Doherty in the private back room. I watched Gone with the Wind for the first time with Shannon at my house because she was supposed to play the book's author, Margaret Mitchell, in a movie. Though all I could think about was putting my dick up her ass because we were on the couch and the thing was practically lying in there. We ended up as good friends, and I let her husband of 5 months, Ashley Hamilton, play at the club. After Shannon, I had a few dates with Vanessa Marcille from General Hospital. We went to see Les Miserables or something. Then I met Christy Turlington at the bar and took her to Las Vegas for the opening of a casino. I happened to run into Tommy Lee there, and we sort of nodded heads and exchanged a smile. At the time, Christy was on my lap and I was teaching her how to play roulette. But nothing ever came of it because I got so fucked up that I passed out and some friends had to carry me up to my room. As soon as I returned to L.A., I met a playmate and actress named Pamela Anderson at Bar One. It turned out that her brother had washed some of my sports cars because he ran a car detailing service. Pam was on Home Improvement at the time, so she took me on our first date to see Tim Allen's stand-up routine. Pamela was dating a lot of people, and so was I. Since I was shooting a video for a solo song I'd recorded, Can't Have Your Cake, I put Pamela in the clip along with Skylar and three girls I was dating at the same time, though none of them knew it. I guess I was trying to make the point that sometimes you can have your cake and eat it too, though I'd soon find out that wasn't true at all. After a few more dates with me, Pamela moved on to Brett Michaels of Poison, and I got started on a playmate jag. In the current Playboy issue, the centerfold had listed as one of her ambitions, "Someday I want to marry a rock star." That same month, Hugh Hefner was having his annual Midsummer Night's Dream party, at which everyone has to show up in sleep attire. Lingerie for the girls, bathrobes for the men. I put on a silk robe and boxer shorts and drove to the party in my Testarossa. My mission was straightforward and simple. I walked into the party, found the centerfold, and said, "I'm your rock star." She was wearing a white teddy with stockings and looked unbelievable. She looked at me and smiled. "Come on, we're wasting time," I continued. "Let's get out of here." We left the party and went to Bar One with our bedclothes still on. By the end of the night, she was so smashed she was dancing on the pool table in her negligee. I took her back to the hotel and tried to take her up to my room. "No," she screamed, "I want to drive the Ferrari first." I sighed and gave her the keys. She pulled out of the hotel, drove on to Sunset, then turned south on San Vicente Boulevard. As she began to turn onto Fountain, she suddenly gunned the gas. I guess she wanted to see how fast the car could accelerate, but you don't do that when you're rounding a corner. The car spun a full 360 degrees and slammed into a truck crossing the intersection. The truck knocked the car into a northbound lane on San Vicente, and my centerfold freaked out and tried to speed away. She made it about 5 feet before she plowed into a van, which completed the devastation of my Ferrari. She crawled out of the car in her underwear and staggered to the curb. I walked out, looked at the smoke rising from the scrap heap that was once my pride and joy, and started cursing her out, calling her every name I could think of as I stood there with my boxer shorts flapping in the wind. She burst into tears, crying until the police showed up and hauled her off to jail for DUI. She looked ravishing in the leather backseat of the cop car, handcuffed in her lingerie with her blonde hair a tangled mess, her face streaked with makeup. Another cop car drove me back to the Bellage. I changed my clothes, bailed her out, brought her back to the hotel, and finally got laid. We were so bonded by the events of that night that we dated for a little while after that. And I learned that she wasn't actually the kind of girl who destroyed everything she touched. She just destroyed everything she touched that belonged to me. Amidst all this chaos, I quickly and painlessly completed my first album, Exposed, at the record plant with Steve Stevens of Billy Idol's band on lead guitar, who had just left a group with Mike Monroe of Hanoi, Vicky Fox of Enough's Enough on drums, Dave Marshall on rhythm guitar, and on bass, Robbie Crane, who used to work sound on porn movies. Eventually, I fired Fox and hired Randy Castillo, the crazy long-haired rocker who, since coming to my mud wrestling parties, had made a reputation for himself playing with the Motels and Lita Ford, and more recently, Tommy had hooked him up with Ozzy Osbourne. While I was working on some drum tracks with Ron Nevison, we received an unexpected phone call. My manager, Bruce, had collapsed with a brain aneurysm. In our short time together, I'd grown to love Bruce like a father. Ron and I walked to a nearby bar, loaded up on drinks while crying on each other's shoulders, then went to the hospital to visit him. We arrived too late. He was dead. When a mutual friend, Bert Stein, heard what had happened, he offered to help out until I found a new manager. He never stopped managing me, and together, we bonded through more dark days and deaths than we ever thought could be possible in a lifetime. When I returned to the studio, someone brought in a vivid video porn star named Janine Lindemulder, who I started dating and later cast in one of my videos. Every model who appeared in one of my solo videos was someone I was dating. As soon as we finished the album, I brought her and a friend of mine, a penthouse pet, to Hawaii to celebrate. One of them brought a video camera, and when we were all fucked up one night, set it up and taped the action. After the trip, I never saw either girl again until I took a trip to Palm Springs months later. They were both there and dating each other. I had hooked them up. You'd be surprised how often that happens. I didn't think anything about the two of them until years later, when after the Pamela and Tommy home video leaked out, my tape was suddenly on the market. I thought that Janine had sold it for money because I never had a copy. I was pissed at her, but refrained from suing her or calling her out publicly because I didn't want to draw any more attention to the sex tape. Fortunately, I didn't do anything because I later found out through the tape's distributor that the other girl had leaked it, which made sense when I finally watched the video because her face had been blurred out. After Palm Springs, I started checking out a club called Denim and Diamonds, where bikers and models mixed. And I decided that Bar One should have a night like that. We talked Jägermeister into sponsoring the event and bringing in the Jägermeister girls. I had never tasted Jägermeister before, so I had no idea how potent it was. I don't remember much of what happened later that night. I somehow walked outside, climbed on my Harley, and rode down the pavement into the door of the club. The place was completely packed, and as I revved up the bike and cruised onto the dance floor, the wheel slipped out from under me and the bike hit the floor and slid into a row of tables. I landed on my back on the dance floor and passed out. I woke up, sick, embarrassed, and thankful I hadn't killed anyone or myself. I don't think I'd ever been that out of control on liquor before. I lay in bed sweating and vomiting for 2 days with alcohol poisoning. That ended my midlife crisis. I couldn't go on behaving like that anymore. I had to grow up and accept the fact that I was an adult with responsibilities, though of course that didn't mean I still couldn't have fun. I moved out of the Bellage and bought my own home, a huge gothic-looking house called Sea Manor in Malibu. Not only did I need to get out of Hollywood, but I wanted a place that Skylar would enjoy. Visiting me in Hollywood was never much fun for her. I set up a room in the house for her with a little desk and a kiddie computer. She loved visiting the house, and every morning dragged me out of bed and onto the beach, where we'd make sandcastles as tall as her and spend hours telling stories about the kings and queens and rock stars who lived in them. In the quiet of Malibu, I also put together a new band to promote Exposed. The album had hit number 13 on the pop charts, so we landed our first tour opening up for Van Halen. It was a humbling experience because I hadn't opened for anyone in years, and because I was touring with the band that had replaced its lead singer and was doing pretty well. Sammy Hagar, who was filling in for David Lee Roth, quickly became a good friend, and we put ourselves on a schedule of downing kamikazes before my show and margaritas before his. He ended up with the short end of the deal because he was always wasted before he hit the stage. After leaving the Sheds with Van Halen, we headlined a club tour on our own, which was even more humbling because I hadn't played in places that small since Rock Candy. Now that I was solo, I had to do all the interviews, write all the songs, make up the set lists, figure out the marketing, approve all the artwork, and deal with everything. I learned more on that album and tour than in my entire time with Motley. But the grind quickly wore me down, and as soon as I found an opportunity to get off the road, I retreated to the comfort of Malibu and Skylar. My house was the most opulent place I'd ever lived in, with a spiral staircase running through the center topped by a dome of stained glass. It looked like the perfect setting for a porn movie, so I started renting it out for porn shoots and for penthouse centerfold shoots when my daughter wasn't around. Afterward, I'd get to date the pets. Life reverted to the time before I met Charisse, and I was playing at being a mini Hugh Hefner. I'd invite my buddies over all the time, and we'd kick back and watch the shoots. If the crew was cool, we'd throw beach parties, and neighbors like John Lovitz and Charlie Miner would come by. On one of the penthouse shoots, there was a makeup artist named Alexis, who also worked on the big Playboy shoots. She was showing me her Polaroids, and a chill ran through my body when I saw the cover model for the April issue of Playboy. She was as skinny, blonde, and big-titted as could be, and that was all I needed to see. I have to meet this girl, I told Alexis. Alexis couldn't promise anything because the girl was an actress from Palm Beach. But soon after, she came to town and was staying at the Playboy Mansion. She called me, introduced herself as Heidi Mark, and said she could go out with me that night but had to be back early for a 7 a.m. photo shoot. I picked her up at the Playboy Mansion and took her to a friend's birthday party. I was amazed when Heidi wasn't disgusted watching us toss $100 bills at strippers like confetti. She was a tomboy, trapped in the shell of a Barbie doll, and she enjoyed the whole spectacle. Afterward, I offered to drive her back to Hef's, but she said, I don't really need to go back there. Ever since Hef's been married, the mansion's been dead. But what about the 7 a.m. photo shoot? I asked. I sort of made that up in case I didn't like you. She smiled. We went to my house, and she stayed there for a week until she had to leave for Orlando to tape a show called Thunder in Paradise. Our second date was in the Bahamas. Michael Peters, who owns the Pure Platinum chain of strip clubs, had become a good buddy of mine. Back when we were recording the single Girls, 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 I had played it for him in his Lamborghini, and he promised on the spot that the song would be played every hour on the hour in every club he owned, and he has kept that promise to this day. After my week in L.A. with Heidi, Michael and I flew 15 girls, each smuggling baggies of coke in whatever orifice they could hide them, in two Lear jets to a place called Hurricane Hole, where he had a 90-foot yacht anchored and a film crew hired to document it all. On day three, I was cruising across the bay in a wave runner with a topless blonde on the back when I happened to glance toward the beach. Sitting there on top of a pile of luggage, with her arms folded angrily over her chest, was a girl who looked very familiar. It was Heidi. I had forgotten that she was arriving that day. Instinctively, I jabbed my elbow back and knocked the blonde off the back of the wave runner and then sped to the beach. I thought somehow, when she saw me arrive alone, she'd think the topless blonde was a trick the 3 p.m. sunshine had played on her eyes. After a few days of hanging out with nude women on Michael's boat, Heidi decided that if we were to have anything resembling a healthy relationship, we would have to find somewhere to stay on our own. So we moved into a house Michael owned and used it as a love shack until, a few days later, my jet ski hit a coral reef and I flew over the top, cracking two ribs on the hard coral. Our relationship pretty quickly became one disaster after another. After the Bahamas, Michael took it upon himself to butter up Heidi's father. So we looked up the address of her father's office in Palm Beach and sent him a motherload of paraphernalia from the dollhouse, pure platinum and solid gold. Everything from t-shirts to soft porn videos of the girls. He'd been in the business for so long, he thought that any red-blooded male would be glad to receive his stripper gifts. Unfortunately, he didn't know that Heidi's dad was a divorce lawyer, and her grandmother worked as the receptionist in his office. When the old lady opened it, she had a fit. To make matters worse, Michael had enclosed a note with the package that read, "Dear John, thank you for raising such a great girl. Love, Michael." So Heidi's whole family thought she was dating Michael. When they read in the local papers that Michael had gotten arrested for violating the RICO Anti-Racketeering Act in Florida for drugs, money laundering, and liquor license violations, they practically disowned her. The only good that came out of it was that when they discovered Heidi was dating me, they were actually relieved. Now that my single life was over, I pulled out of Bar One. My partners went on to start the only strip club to get a license to operate in Beverly Hills, the Beverly Club. Instead, I spent my time with Heidi at a Malibu restaurant called Moonshadows, where Fran Drescher, Gary Busey, and Kelsey Grammer all hung out. Everything began to return to normal except for my mail. Once a week, I'd receive a manila envelope that contained a photograph of me and Heidi lying out by the pool or in bed. I thought we were being stalked by a jealous fan until Heidi told me that her ex-fiancé had been a vice cop and was sending DEA helicopters to spy on us. I interpreted this as a warning and flushed all the cocaine I could find in the house. My contact at Warner Brothers, Michael Austin, hooked me up with a pair of producers who called themselves the Dust Brothers for my next album. They had made a great album with the Beastie Boys, but had not yet struck pay dirt with Beck and Hanson, and it was very frustrating working with them. I would record something with one of them while the other left the room to smoke pot. When we were through, the guy who had left would return and say what we did sucked. Then they'd switch places and we'd go through the same routine again. It was like trying to make an album with Cheech and Chong. They weren't into songs or production at all. They were computer cut-and-paste guys, so that whatever I finished when I left the studio one night would sound completely different the next morning. It was a frustrating experience. But somehow, as if by the magic of the marijuana fairy, we ended up with a pretty cool album. 8 years before Kid Rock and Limp Bizkit, it mixed rap beats with rock guitars. And because no one was making any music like that at the time, Warner Brothers didn't know what to do with it. As they were deciding, drama struck in the executive suites and a power struggle resulted in massive firings. Suddenly, I was at the label with nobody on my side and a completed record with a release date that kept getting pushed back month after month. I was ready to hit the road again, but I was stuck in limbo. I'd become obsessed with racing since leaving the band, so I plunged myself into that world. I'd driven half a season in the Indy Lights and loved it. The focus, the fans, and the rush were like being on stage at a rock concert. If you made a mistake, everybody saw it. At the Long Beach Grand Prix, a car hit me on the third lap. My car swerved sideways and the wing hit the wall, snapping the bracket that holds it to the chassis. In the pit, the crew took off the wing, which is what keeps the car's back end from flying off the ground when you drive, and I tried to finish the race without it. I cruised out of the pit, down the straightaway, and as I hit a kink in the road, flipped into third gear. Instantly, the car spun out of control and slammed into the wall. The crowd roared, and I stumbled out unharmed except for the red flush of humiliation on my face. The team I was driving for was called Pig Racing, and it was mostly made up of cops and former cops. The crew consisted of guys from their SWAT team, and I put millions of dollars into my cars and engines and a trailer. One day, one of the officers who ran the team disappeared, and I received a notice that he'd been arrested for selling coke out of the police evidence locker, which was probably how he funded the team and gone bankrupt. So everything I had was seized. I never saw my cars again, though I later saw him hanging around the races. After finishing the album with the Dust Brothers, I began driving in the amateur celebrity races. That April, after celebrating my daughter Skylar's 4th birthday, I went to Long Beach to drive in the Grand Prix again. I finished in second place and came off the track exhilarated. That night, there was a party at the hotel where most of the drivers were staying, and I started to celebrate. An hour into the debauchery, a hotel staff member ran up to me. He said I had a phone call in the lobby. I picked it up, expecting Heidi. I wanted so badly to tell her how well I had raced. But it wasn't Heidi calling at all. It was my estranged wife, Charisse, and she was crying so hard she could hardly complete a sentence. Skylar's in the hospital. She struggled between sobs to expel each word. Her appendix exploded. She wants her daddy.